This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
I think it's very fitting that with the new School of Peace being launched at this university, which prides itself on values, ethics, and social justice, that we launch it with the champion of human rights, and that is Ken Roth, the executive director of Human Rights Watch, the largest U.S.-based human rights organization in this country. Kenneth Roth is going to be speaking this evening on the dynamics of human rights and the environment. This is a theme that will permeate many of the activities of the Institute over the coming academic year, looking as we are at climate change, and as this is a focus also of the United Nations this year. This is a topic that is of great concern to many. We have a graduate course in the master's program on environmental justice. I'm sure we have other courses at the university that relate to this topic. And we are delighted that he is going to be speaking on this. He has a long history in human rights, but the connection with the environment is newer, as we have learned. Human Rights Watch began its work in 1978, and now under Kenneth Roth's leadership since 1993, it has grown to have a staff of around 260 people in many different locations in the world. I believe you have this in your program. You have a short bio in your program. They conduct fact-finding investigations into human rights violations around the world. Aldous Huxley once said that facts do not cease to exist because they're ignored. The mission of Human Rights Watch is to publish these facts and to bring them into the light of day to shame governments and other human rights violators into changing the policies and practices that so abuse human rights. Human Rights Watch seeks to surface facts that are buried by perpetrators of torture, extrajudicial killings, human trafficking, and environmental destruction. This often means speaking out against abuses here at home. Ken Roth has written articles for journals and reviews, including on sensitive topics here at home, including issues of torture and terrorism in Guantanamo that some in the administration would prefer we not talk about. I met Ken Roth a number of years ago, 1994 to be exact, in September, at the Carter Center at a meeting of human rights directors, U.S.-based human rights directors. This occurred just after former President Carter, had returned from a mission to Haiti with General Colin Powell and Senator Sam Nunn. Their mission was to help avoid an invasion of Haiti because the democratically elected president had been overthrown by a military dictator, Raul Cedras, and the U.S. was planning to invade Haiti. And so Carter, Sam Nunn, and Colin Powell went down to try to avoid this invasion by negotiating some kind of a deal with Cedras. Well, the deal that they negotiated basically gave immunity to Cedras and allowed him to leave and go away quietly, even though he was responsible for the murder of thousands of people. Shortly after President Carter returned to Atlanta, there was a meeting of the human rights directors, of which Ken Roth was a prominent member. And I remember sitting in that room when President Carter walked in, walking into, little did he know, one of the most contentious sessions I have ever seen, in which the human rights directors lambasted him, saying, "How can you call yourself a champion of human rights when you do anything for peace, but there's no justice?" And this ability to speak truth to power is something that we all want to have, but not many of us are brave enough to have it. And in all my years at the Carter Center, that was maybe one out of two or three occasions in 9 years that I ever saw people actually try to hold President Carter's feet to the fire. And again, Ken Roth was prime among those. And so it is with great pleasure that I welcome him to this stage this evening to speak on the dynamics of human rights and environmental rights. Thank you.
I remember that session well, although I should say, though, that, I mean, President Carter, for me, was a hero. And he was really part of why I'm doing what I did today, because when I was in law school, he was president, and he had introduced this radical idea that U.S. foreign policy should not just be about advancing national interests, it should also be about defending human rights. And that, frankly, is part of what inspired me, you know, not to go and do whatever else I might have done, but to go into human rights. So I may have been lambasting him, but it was, you know, with great admiration. it's a pleasure for me to be here. And I have a confession to make at the outset. I mentioned this to a number of the students earlier today, but this is not my first trip to USD. I was here once 20 years ago. I was applying for a job. literally. I at the time was a prosecutor, had been finishing up my 4 years, and was thinking about being a law professor. And I had gone initially to what they call the meat market in Chicago, where you have a different interview every 20 minutes with a different law school, and you try to remember which law school is where. And USD invited me to come here and give a speech and a presentation and, you know, the whole Megillah. And it was, you know, a lovely place. But a couple days later, I got a phone call from Human Rights Watch. Would I like a job there? And so, you know, the paths diverged, and I went the Human Rights Watch route, and I never made it to USD until now. But it's lovely to be back. And I have to say, I'm especially thrilled to be able to be speaking at a lecture sponsored by Joan Kroc, because I have been a tremendous admirer of Joan Kroc, even though I never met the woman. But I have spoken at the Kroc Institute at Notre Dame. I have followed her commitment to global education and social justice. I think that she, you know, the fact that she bolstered National Public Radio is, you know, that's one of our national treasures, and it's just, you know, it's to her credit. There are very few women like her who have the breadth of vision and the commitment and the generosity that she did. So I feel very honored. Now, as Joyce mentioned, although the focus of this talk this evening is the intersection between the environment and human rights, I am not here as an expert on the environment. I will confess that right up front. I do know a little bit about human rights. But as I thought about this lecture, I realized that I run into environmental issues all the time. And that while, you know, if you look at our website, there's not a big headline environment. Nonetheless, we at Human Rights Watch are bumping into environmental issues all the time. And I thought that I could really draw from our experience to talk a little bit about ways in which the human rights movement and the environmental movement have much in common as partners, as people who share similar goals, and as people who should be working more together than frankly we are. Now, before I do that, let me just explain for a moment what Human Rights Watch is and how we operate, because I think it'll help you understand my point of view a little bit better. Joyce alluded to how we work. Human Rights Watch has what we call researchers, or basically investigators, in about 80 countries around the world. Basically every place you can imagine where there is, you know, an awful dictator or an abusive war, we're there. And our job is to put as much pressure as we can on the governments in question to respect human rights, which we do in a pretty straightforward way. It's not rocket science. It's difficult in practice, but the theory is pretty simple. We investigate what we do by speaking to the victims and the witnesses and putting together as complete a picture as we can of their misconduct, which we then publish in the form of a report. And we put this report on our website, which is available for the public, hrw.org. But we also send it to the press. And the idea is to expose these atrocities to the world, because nobody these days wants their human rights crimes exposed. It's their dirty laundry. It's like being called a child abuser. I mean, it's just nobody wants that. And so that shaming process can be very powerful. It can discourage governments from committing abuses because they know that their reputation and their legitimacy are at stake. Then, to top it off, We have advocates in key capitals around the world, in many of the most powerful governments. And we go to them and we say, use your influence to help us. So when you're meeting with this dictator, tell him he's not going to get his next arms shipment until he stops torturing people. Or tell him that that next tranche of military aid's not going to be coming until he lets the following dissidents out of jail. Or say that you're not going to arrange a high-profile presidential summit with this thug until he starts behaving. And these kinds of pressures can make a huge difference. Now, what does this have to do with the environment? I first realized the connection between human rights and the environment. It now was, I guess, 13 years ago. It was 1994. And I don't know how many of you remember the name Ken Saro-Wiwa. Is that a name? There's some heads that are nodding. Ken Saro-Wiwa was a Nigerian environmental activist. He was an Ogoni, was his ethnic group, in the Niger River Delta in an area called Ogoniland. And he was the head of an organization, MOSOP, the Movement for the Support of the Ogoni People. Ken Saro-Wiwa and his organization were concerned with the environmental degradation caused by the oil industry in the Niger River Delta, by Shell in particular. Yes, you remember. And what they found was not only were there oil spills that were contaminating the water, there were these flares that were the excess gas. They at that point were not collecting the gas; they were just burning it off. That was heating up the environment. It was it was polluting, and they were trying to insist that Shell, on the one hand, and the Nigerian government on the other, as sort of the overseer of Shell, stop this despoiling of their environment, ruining their fishing grounds, ruining the villages where they live. This, unfortunately for Ken Saro-Wiwa, was at the time when Nigeria was run by a dictator named Sani Abacha, who was as awful as they come. And Abacha arranged to arrest on trumped-up charges Ken Saro-Wiwa and eight of his colleagues in MOSOP, sentenced them to death, and after a 6 or 8 month wait, hung them all. And it was an utter outrage. Now, this woke the world up. And there were a number of lessons that we learned from this. I mean, first was that if you're going to have a clean environment, you have to have the political space for people to be able to protest, for the people who are most affected by the environmental hazards to be able to speak out, organize against them, and try to change that behavior. That's what Ken Saro-Wiwa was done, and that's what he was killed for. Second, this was in many ways the birth of the movement of corporate social responsibility. Because at that stage, Shell was basically saying, well, what do you want us to do? This is it's an environmental problem. Don't bother us. We're just here to make money for our shareholders. And that was the typical line back then. I remember talking to business leaders at the time and saying, would you worry about, could you help us stop this labor rights abuse, or could you help us with this police abuse? And they would say, that's your business. That's not our business. We're here just to make money. Shell's reputation was utterly destroyed at the time. It was also right about the time as the Brent Spar episode in the North Sea. And that kind of 1-2 punch actually transformed Shell from being, the symbol of retrograde corporate conduct to being actually an extremely responsible corporate citizen. And they ended up taking the lead in the corporate social responsibility movement and were sort of an object study for how corporations, for their own good, have to be attentive to human rights and environmental issues. That if they don't, they risk their reputation, which in turn loses them customers, investors, employees, you name it. That you cannot run an effective business if you are indifferent to these reputational risks that are involved in environmental or human rights abuse. We also, frankly, learned that civil society of the sort that Ken Saro-Wiwa represents is sort of like the canary in the mine shaft. that if you don't deal with problems as they arise early on, as local people affected by these problems speak out against them, things are going to go from bad to worse. And it's odd to think back to the Ken Saro-Wiwa days as almost being the halcyon days for the Niger River Delta. But awful as it sounds for this group to be rounded up and executed, today the Niger River Delta is basically at war with gangs roaming and kidnapping people, fighting back and forth for just their little snatch of the oil revenue. There a lot of them are just sort of tapping into the oil fields. The environment is a complete disaster. And it sort of shows that repression is not the answer. Repression often just makes things worse. Let me give you a few other examples just from my work in this field. One company that I can't say has reformed through the process, but that we dealt with before anybody had any idea, is Enron. And I actually still remember when we put out the report, we were terrified of a libel suit. Everybody thought that this was this wonderful company, and what were we going to be doing saying something bad about it? Little did we know. But at the time, Enron was in the process of building a power plant in India called the Dabhol power plant. And this was an enormous environmental concern because it was seen as diverting scarce water in that region. The locals were worried about a kind of a range of environmental damage. It also, frankly, was an awful deal economically. There clearly was some bribery involved. And so India was going to be charged much more for electricity than they could get anyplace else. It was just a rotten, rotten deal, except for Enron, which was going to profit handsomely from this. So naturally, this combination of an environmental disaster and an economic disaster sparked protests. And what did Enron do? Well, it called in the local police thugs to take care of the protests. And they started beating the environmentalists. So that's what brought Human Rights Watch in. And we interviewed people and we recorded their plight and we put together a big report outlining the environmental damage, the economic debacle, and the repression. And put this report out, and it got massive press because Enron was sort of a high-flying company and they never did anything wrong. But it showed that there is this connection between repression and damage to the environment. Now, at that stage, Enron, unlike Shell, didn't start behaving responsibly. They just responded with this massive PR effort. And so we were sort of in this fight with them for a while in the press, but they never reformed. Maybe if they had reformed, we wouldn't think of Enron the way we do today. But, that's history. A more contemporary example, China. If you think around the world today, China may well represent the greatest environmental hazard that we face. It's not only that it's a billion plus people, so even a small environmental problem multiplied by a billion adds up very quickly. But in China you have the problem of essentially unaccountable local government officials who are utterly indifferent to the environment. They have found that the best way to get rich quick is to let whatever business wants to come in. They basically hand out land for free, stealing it from peasants. They are indifferent to environmental regulations. Whatever it is to make a quick buck. And these kind of corrupt, abusive local officials have sparked enormous protest across China. I don't think people are necessarily really aware of the extent of it. But by the Chinese government's own count, I remember a couple years ago when they were still publishing these figures, they said that there were 70,000 incidents of public unrest in the course of 1 year. So, tens of thousands of incidents a year at minimum. And these are largely about the environment. They also are simply, protests against getting their land seized. They're protests against extortion and other forms of corruption. But a lot of it is, people simply not wanting their streams and rivers polluted, not wanting to have to live next to a smokestack, not wanting to have to live on top of a toxic waste disposal site. And nobody cares in the government. Or what I should say is nobody cares at the local level. In Beijing, at the leadership, they know that they've got a big problem. But because you know, China is anything but a democracy, interestingly, it is difficult for the senior leadership to really control things, because the same dynamic that promotes corruption and abuse at the local level also promotes corruption and abuse at the middle level and on up. And so, you know, even if you have a senior leader who is well-intentioned and who wants to rein in these lower-level officials, by the time the order works its way down the chain of command, there's no order left to speak of. Now, we have been speaking with the Chinese government and trying to encourage them. We say, like, you know, there's a solution to this problem. You can't do it all through a command economy. But if you let the people who are most affected by an environmental problem address that problem, they'll take care of it themselves. You know, let people speak out about environmental problems. You know, let them organize protests against those problems. You know, let them bring the abusers to court and ask them to justify themselves before a judge. You know, actually apply the rule of law to the government. You know, a novel idea in China. And, you know, the Chinese government sort of thought about that for a while and said, well, you know, that all makes a lot of sense, except if you start letting people organize, you know, they may start organizing not just about their little village, but they may start organizing about Beijing. And before you know it, we're going to have a Tiananmen Square democracy movement again. So no thank you. And they started arresting the lawyers and arresting the environmental activists and shutting down the press that was too outspoken about these issues. And that's where we are today. So we find ourselves, you know, fighting for human rights, which in this case is fighting for a clean environment. We are fighting to defend the activists that are trying to defend the earth. And so what all this demonstrates to me is that a good barometer of environmental degradation is the scope of repression. And I suspect that if you do a map of the world, and on the one hand do an overlay of repression, and then you do an overlay of environmental problems, you will find enormous overlap. Because, you know, the best defense of the environment is permitting the people who are most affected by environmental problems, letting them speak out and address those problems. The role of a human rights organization like Human Rights Watch is not necessarily to go out and defend the earth in that immediate sense, but our job is to defend the political space to allow environmental activists to operate within. And in that sense, there's an enormous compatibility between the two movements. And what's more, we've been talking about sort of, in a sense, local problems, you know, the Niger River Delta, you know, India, China. But today, when the paramount environmental problem affecting us is global warming, climate change, these local problems are no longer just local. Because if you have a factory that is, you know, emitting carbon beyond what it should, you know, if you have local government that is ignoring the need to rein in global warming, then even if it's happening in some local place far away, it affects all of us. You know, the solution to this global problem does have to start locally, but it requires all of us to ensure that the rights to defend our environment exist not only here in San Diego, but elsewhere in the world, because otherwise it's going to come back and hurt us here. So it really, in a sense, forces a global awareness and a global solution upon us, which is very much rights dependent. Now, why do governments permit so much environmental damage? You know, you'd think that even a relatively unenlightened government would recognize that, you know, our days are numbered if we don't start addressing these problems. Part of the reason they don't is you know, the China reason, that the solutions are sometimes too politically risky, because obviously the last thing any dictator wants is a vigorous civil society and a free press and, you know, a range of political parties, you know, seeking power. But part of the problem is, frankly, that damaging the environment can be lucrative in the short term, you know, if you're in the right place at the right time. And this is something that Human Rights Watch encounters all the time, and it's a way in which we, I suppose, can address the incentives for environmental damage in addition to the possible solutions. So, you know, not only are we defending civil society and those activists that are trying to protect the environment, but we also have begun to attack the reasons why governments find it convenient to allow the environment to be despoiled. Let me give you an example. We've talked about Nigeria. And today, there is a formula in place in Nigeria where the federal government takes in all this massive oil revenue. It should be a rich country. Takes in this revenue and distributes it to the various states in Nigeria. And those states, in turn, are supposed to be responsible for providing various social services like school and health care. So if you travel around Nigeria, it doesn't take long to figure out that this system isn't working, that there is enormous poverty, and that the basic social services that you would expect from a government are not being provided. So Human Rights Watch thought, well, let's look at why that is. Let's see if we can try to make some improvement there. And so we conducted a study in River State, one of the states in the Niger River Delta. And we basically said, well, what's happening to the money? In this case, River State gets $1.3 billion a year from the federal government. That's not pocket change. In fact, that's more than the GDP of most West African governments. And it's just a tiny little state. Of that money, 2.4%, a tiny, tiny part, goes to rebuilding the crumbling schools. 30% goes to salaries and offices, the important stuff of government officials. But the real money, we found, goes to a handful of people at the top. And just to give you a sense, we found that the state governor himself, one person, had a travel budget of $65,000 a day. you can imagine the plane he travels in. Plus, he had a budgetary allocation for grants, contributions, and donations of an extra $92,000 a day. So you can imagine his Swiss bank account is well padded. There also were 100 protocol officers on staff whose function was utterly unclear, but whose salaries were more than the entire health sector in River State. So this money is, on the one hand being squandered. It is not serving the Nigerian people in the least. But it is also providing a huge incentive for the government to cling to power and to repress anybody who might challenge them, including those pesky environmental activists who are complaining about the Niger River Delta where this wealth is being generated. And give you another example where we did something similar. Angola, another potentially rich African country, refused to publish its budget. Because if you publish your budget, people will start asking questions, What do you mean? My school got all this money. I don't see anything. What about my hospital here? So better just not to publish it. So Human Rights Watch published it. We got it leaked to us, and we published it. And what we found was that in the course of 5 years, from 1997 to 2002, $4.2 billion disappeared. Just gone. Now that, to put it in perspective, is the amount of money that the Angolan state spent on all forms of social services in those 5 years. So basically, healthcare, education, roads, electricity, clean water, everything could have been doubled but for this corruption. And, the effect of this corruption is a disaster for the environment. It provides an incentive to these government officials to keep the flow of oil going, regardless of the cost. It makes them, utterly unresponsive to their people because they don't need taxes. They just take the oil wealth. We all hate taxes, but when you think about it, when you pay taxes, you expect something from your government. If you don't pay taxes, you have less of a call to demand things of your government. So these governments would just as soon take the oil wealth and run with it and leave, people can keep their taxes. It obviously creates a tremendous incentive to cling to power through repression or other means. And thus, it provides an incentive to repress civil society and make it impossible for people to examine not only their corruption, but also things like environmental degradation. And these problems arise not just from the oil industry, but really from many situations where governments are exploiting natural resources. So, you know, for example, if you look at the logging industry, you get massive deforestation much of Southeast Asia is where we've encountered, in Kalimantan in Indonesia, in Cambodia, in Burma. But again, you know, the government doesn't care about the environment because it's just too lucrative to stop the logging industry. We see something similar happening today where palm oil has become the new biofuel. And so there are areas of Colombia where the paramilitaries, these murderous thugs who have killed, you know, thousands upon thousands of people, are suddenly taking land, just, you know, walking in and saying, you know, this used to be your land, right? And seizing people's land to build, you know, in a sense, palm plantations because of this lucrative new industry. You know, again, destroying, in this case, a rural environment in the process. But whenever, you know, the elite can live off the land, they don't need to live off the people, and therefore they don't need to be responsive to popular needs, including the need for a clean environment. So these are various ways in which respect for human rights is connected to respect for the environment, where violation of human rights is directly related to violation of the environment. Now, let me talk about a few other situations that often come up in these discussions about the connection. One is Darfur. And Darfur is an interesting case. I mean, some people say that Darfur is the first war induced by climate change. And there's an element of truth of that, although I don't want to overstate it. The element of truth is that there has been a process of desertification in the sub-Saharan region. And this is undoubtedly connected to global warming. This gradual creeping of the desert south has increased competition for land. In the case of Darfur, you have, on the one hand, the largely Arab tribes who tend to be nomadic with their herds of animals crossing this land. And on the other hand, the largely African tribes who are mostly agriculturalists who are trying to farm this land. And you know, there was always a certain tension between these two groups of people, but they had worked it out over the eons. But as the land is shrinking, the tensions rise. And so that did in many ways lie behind a sense on the part of the African tribes that they were being neglected by the government in Khartoum, which they felt was siding with the Arab nomads. And so the African tribes got together and created an insurgency. And they announced their insurgency in February 2003 by attacking the military air base in El Fasher, North Darfur, and destroying the handful of military planes that were there. So they've arrived, a rebellion. The Sudanese government decided to fight this insurgency the way it had fought the insurgency in southern Sudan for the prior 21 years. And that's the classic, you know, drain the sea to kill the fish approach. Meaning, they assumed that an insurgency would not be able to survive without support of ordinary civilians from their ethnic groups. And so they thought they would just get rid of the civilians. That's what they did. They basically would go into a village. The military operating with this group, the Janjaweed, which is basically these armed thugs on horseback and camelback. And they'd, you know, arrive at a village, kill enough people so that everybody else fled, and then they'd burn down the village. And they would do this over and over and over again. Rape a few women in the process if they could. And gradually, you have 2.4 million people who are living in refugee camps in Darfur. You have 4 million people who are utterly dependent on international assistance because they can't dare go home because they'll get killed. Now, while this conflict was related to climate change, the reason I say I don't want to overstate it is that it wasn't Mother Nature that decided to start slaughtering people. It was Omar al-Bashir, the Sudanese leader. And it's important that we not forget that. The solution to this will have environmental dimensions. We have to figure out, how to make it possible for these people to coexist. But we shouldn't forget that there is a leadership in Khartoum that is a bunch of war criminals. And the solution to this is to, frankly, prosecute these people because they are, responsible for mass atrocities. And we also need to deploy a UN peacekeeping force to try to protect the people of Darfur, which they're in desperate need of. And these are two areas where Human Rights Watch has been devoting a lot of attention. We've actually gotten a couple of people indicted by the International Criminal Court. The UN Security Council has now promised to deploy 20,000 peacekeepers beginning next month. So I'm, guardedly optimistic that we're on our way. But this is, an enormous problem that clearly has been exacerbated by environmental problems. I think Darfur illustrates another connection between human rights and the environment, and that is that one way for us to understand the consequences of environmental degradation is in terms of rights. It's not simply rights as part of the solution, but rights are also part of the description of the problem. In the case of Darfur, the rights at stake are enormous. The right to life, the right to continue to live in your village without having the government burn it down. But there are other rights that are at stake as well. Here in the United States, when we think of rights, we tend to think of, constitutional rights, civil rights, things basically having to do with our essential freedoms to speak out, to organize, not to be arrested, not to be killed. But there is another body of rights in international human rights law known as economic, social, and cultural rights. And those are very important as well. The right to health, the right to a job, the right to food and housing. The right to the basic necessities that you need to live is what that's about. And one way to understand damage to the environment is in terms of the consequences to economic, social, and cultural rights. And so, you can think about it in terms of diminishing the arable land, which has consequences for the right to food, or diminishing water resources, which makes it harder to find clean water. You can think about the flooding that is a consequence of global warming and what that has done to major urban areas. You can think about the forced migration that increasingly is a product of people not being able to support themselves in their traditional ways on their land. The vulnerability that they feel when suddenly their livelihood, not only through their lives, but back over the eons, is changed by these sudden shifts in the environment. And the thing that you can't help but notice as you start looking at these problems around the world is how often the poorest people are the ones who are most victimized. The environment and its problems seem always to discriminate against the most vulnerable. And I think that's part of why the concept of environmental justice is so important. Because this comes up in so many different ways. It's never a coincidence that the toxic waste site is located next to the poor neighborhood. It happens over and over and over again because the poor neighborhood is not terribly powerful politically. And so the people there don't have the capacity to protest. But the poor neighborhood is also the most vulnerable to the kinds of changes that we're describing. And so, if there's a lack of clean water, they're the first one to feel it. If the economy is being hurt by the environment, they're the first ones to feel that. So, all of this shows that it's important when you look at the environment and the problems that we're facing today to, in a sense, use human rights as an analytic tool, as a way of helping us better understand what the very human consequences are of environmental damage. So, what I've tried to do with all of this tonight is to talk about really the compatibility between the fight for human rights and the fight for a clean environment. But I would be remiss if I ended without addressing what I think inevitably would otherwise come up in questions, and that is, is there a right to a clean environment? Does it make sense to talk about that, pure and simple? And the answer, I have to say, is yes and no. And let me explain myself. I don't know how many of you have seen the film, The 11th Hour, the Leonardo DiCaprio film, where he talks, it wasn't not Leonardo at one stage, but one of the people in the film is talking about, even the land has rights. You know, I'm used to people having rights, but does it make sense for the land to have rights? You know, I'm not sure. But let's dissect that a little bit. There are a number of treaties and declarations and instruments at the international level that do speak in terms of a right to a clean environment in one way or another. The document that I work most closely with in that regard is something known as the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which talks about the right to environmental and industrial hygiene, which is 1966E's language for a right to a clean environment. The rights outlined in this treaty are not rights that are supposed to be produced tomorrow like that. Rather, they are rights that impose a specific duty on governments. And the duty is, and this is legalese, forgive me, to progressively realize these rights on the basis of available resources. That's the language. Even though that's a little mushy, it's meaningful. Because, in plain English, what it means is you've got to be conscientious about working for these things. You can't squander the money the way that Nigeria does. You can't discriminate against people the way, so many governments do. So this concept of a right to a clean environment, I think, does have some usefulness, and in different ways. Let me outline those ways. I mean, first of all, and this is maybe the most obvious, it can be a useful rallying cry. And I don't want to diminish the importance of that because, most of us are used to thinking of rights as sort of trump cards. If you say, I have an interest in a clean environment, that gets you so far. But if you say, I have a right to a clean environment, it sounds like, you can really assert that right over other things. Protesters and demonstrators like to talk in rights terms because it does tend to elevate their cause. And if that's politically useful, by all means, do it. I think that, great. At a little more practical level, rights become meaningful if they are enacted into law. And one useful thing to push for is legislation which creates rights. If you get a law saying you got a right to a clean environment, then you got something to point to. You can go to court and force somebody to respect it. Now, there is some movement in this direction, incrementally. I think probably most interestingly these days in Europe, there's something known as the European Court for Human Rights, which, amazingly, I think, to Americans, basically is the Supreme Court of Europe. I mean, the role that our Supreme Court plays in upholding our constitutional rights is the role that the European Court for Human Rights plays in Europe, above all the national courts. We may be amazed as Americans to think that each government is willing to have this sort of international body defend their rights or define their rights, but that's what the Europeans have chosen to do. And it works quite well. And so the European Court has addressed the right to a clean environment and has not gotten quite that far, but it has, for example, insisted that hazardous industries have a duty not to interfere with the right of people to their home, to their family, and to the enjoyment of their property. That's their language. It is said that states have a duty to protect through regulation against environmental hazard and to assess the impact on the environment of various development projects. But it hasn't yet sort of articulated explicitly a right to a clean environment, per se, standing alone. South Africa maybe has come a little bit closer. And I think many of you know that after apartheid, South Africa got together and adopted a constitution that in many ways is the model constitution. It's probably the most progressive constitution in the world in a variety of ways. But in terms of the environment, it talks about a right to environmental protection. It says that there's a right to an environment that is not detrimental to health or well-being. It also talks about a right of access to clean water. So you can see this, gets really much farther. You don't find anything like that in our document. So it's moving in that direction. And one useful thing to do is to try to push for legislation or constitutions that begin to embody this right. The way that Human Rights Watch gets involved with this is sort of the third way that I think rights language is useful, and that is through our methodology of shaming, the methodology that I outlined at the beginning. And our shaming in this area works best when we can show that a government is not progressively realizing this right on the basis of available resources. You know, that it is not conscientiously trying to protect people's right to health or food or clean water or these various elements of the right to a clean environment. And if we show that governments are, you know, are indifferent, are corrupt, are discriminatory, are arbitrary, we can shine our shaming spotlight on them and embarrass them and push them to stop the same way we would try to get them to stop torture or political imprisonment or you know, the more usual kinds of rights violations that we deal with. And this is a useful thing to do, I think, in defending the right to health, because, you know, what is the right to health if you're breathing in pollutants every day? I think it's useful to do in terms of the right to food and clean water, because these are obviously dependent on the ability to have an environment that can supply these things. It's useful to do in terms of environmental justice, pointing out that, you know, it is discriminatory to put the toxic waste site in the poor neighborhood time and time again. It's useful to do even in things, say, like privatization. You get many countries that are privatizing their water supply, say. And the private company comes in and says, well, you know, we can do this more profitably if we just cut out that poor neighborhood. And so we can insist that governments, if they're going to privatize, if they feel that that's a better way to provide water or electricity or whatever, that it do so with regulations that insist that the private utility actually serve the entire community, that it not cherry pick and just go to the wealthy people. So these are all areas where, you know, a rights approach and our shaming methodology can really help to advance respect for the environment. Now, these are all, in a sense, kind of conceptual contributions, maybe political contributions, to the fight for a clean environment. I don't want to pretend, though, that simply reading the rights in various treaties or statutes or constitutions is going to provide the answer to all the difficult questions that we face. Because, you know, probably the greatest challenge to a clean environment are those who quite legitimately say, well, wait a minute, you know, environment's one thing, but we're poor. We want jobs. You know, we want to develop our economy. You know, I need to drive my car to get to work. You know, I need that factory down the road to have a job. So, you know, yeah, it's nice and good to worry about the environment, but I've got a family to feed, and that's got to come first. You know, and those kind of claims, which we've all heard, are quite real. And I don't pretend that anything I've said tonight gives the answer to that very real conflict that in a sense, the world is facing between the imperatives of economic development and the equally compelling imperatives for a clean environment. Where I think human rights can contribute to this debate is by facilitating the debate, by ensuring that all voices are in fact heard. Because I don't think there is a right answer to that question, but I know that there is a right process to get to the answer. And that right process is one where everybody affected on both sides has a say freely. They all have a chance to debate, to organize, to, you know, engage what for us is ordinary politics, but for the much of the world is prohibited because of repression. And I think it's critical if we're going to get that balance right between providing for people and providing for a clean environment that the rights that are, in a sense, go into a vigorous public debate are respected. Now, the final contribution that I think the human rights movement can make to this, to concerns with the environment, has to do with the fact that the environmental problems that we're facing are increasingly global. You know, it's no longer just the stream down the way that's being polluted. As we all know, you know, global warming is a global, by definition, problem. And we need to band together, you know, across national boundaries to affect that. That's something the human rights movement has had a lot of experience doing, because we have had to build global coalitions of activists and NGOs and various civil society organizations to do things like, you know, ban the use of landmines, a campaign that we actually shared in the Nobel Peace Prize through the accomplishment of a treaty that outlaws anti-personnel landmines. We did a similar campaign to ban the use of child soldiers, building coalitions around the world. We did a similar kind of global campaign to create the International Criminal Court. And today, we're creating a new campaign like that to ban the use of cluster bombs. So these are all areas where, you know, there is an interest in this issue in many, many parts of the world. And there is much greater strength addressing them together than addressing these problems country by country in isolation. I suspect that if we really are going to tackle the big environmental problems that we're facing, that we're going to need to build similar global networks. And I think the human rights movement can lead the way because we've been doing this for years. The environmental movement is doing more and more of it, but frankly is not nearly as advanced as the human rights movement in that respect. So let me conclude simply by, you know, stating the obvious. I think that the human rights movement and the environmental movement are obvious and important political allies. They are conceptual allies, they are political allies, and they need each other. You know, we all need a clean environment, and to get there, we all need rights. One critique you often hear of progressive forces these days is that we're all too atomized. You know, that each of us is pursuing our tiny little agenda and we kind of ignore everybody else's. I hope that what I've shown tonight is that there is a tremendous complementarity of interest between two very important movements, that we can be much, much stronger working together, and that given the magnitude of the problems we face, we need that strength in numbers. Thank you very much.
I wonder if I could start with somewhat the naming and shaming issue, because I'm thinking of where the corporate world and the governmental world kind of coincide, and that's in Burma, where you had Unocal exploiting the Yadana oil fields, and then you have the government, which is one of the most repressive on earth. And even though many human rights organizations for more than a decade have named and shamed Burma, it doesn't seem, I'm not an expert on Burma, but it doesn't seem to me to have had much impact. And I'm wondering, A, would you agree that it hasn't had much impact? And secondly, can you maybe explain why and what other options are available to deal with that situation? Both situations.
Well, I mean, first, it's interesting you ask that question now, because I actually think that this is one of the most exciting times in Burma in the last decade. And I don't know how many of you have been following this, but there was the military junta in Burma hiked oil prices tremendously, I think fivefold or something. Nobody quite knows why. They clearly are having economic problems. And that has set off massive protests, led by many of the same monks who in 1988 were leading the democracy movement that Aung San Suu Kyi was at the head of. And the government has been, you know, responding in its usual way in terms of beating people up, but it has also been responding with a certain restraint because it realizes, I think, that the world is watching. And I don't know how it's going to play out. I mean, we're actively involved right now trying to kind of push open the political space for these protests to proceed. But it is, you know, it shows that something that's, you know, is frustratingly persistent, this military dictatorship, also, you know, has a certain brittleness to it. And it could be something like this that cracks it open. I mean, it's too early to say, but we really haven't seen anything like this in a long, long time. I have to say, I'll tell one story about Unocal, though, since you mentioned that. And this is sort of an example of corporate social responsibility at its worst, I suppose. But the Unocal, along with the French company Total, was building a pipeline across Burma. And I remember going in to speak with the general counsel of Unocal up in L.A. And saying, why are you guys doing this? I mean, don't you realize that there's this, you know, incredibly awful government there? And he said, oh, don't worry. You know, we're building a clinic here. And we're building a school there. We're being nice to the people around our pipeline, you know. And I outlined a scenario. I mean, that's often the answer you get. You know, don't talk to us about the big picture. You know, we're you know, throwing a few pennies toward the peons out there. And so I said, well, you can imagine, you know, there's a rebel group operating in this territory. They're going to attack your pipeline. Who's going to defend your pipeline? The, you know, Burmese military, that all they knew how to do is to shoot civilians. And so, you know, sure enough, I mean, literally a week after my meeting with them, there was this attack on the pipeline. Four of the Total workers were killed, and the Burmese government responded as it does. And you know, suddenly the pipeline was being defended, you know, in this awful, abusive way by this, you know, junta that UNICAL was pretending it had nothing to do with. And it ended up being sued and paying a very big judgment because of this whole process. But it shows that you know, corporate social responsibility is not only the nice thing to do, it's also sort of the smart thing to do if you are at all enlightened. But this was a little bit of the old days, and UNICAL had not yet gotten to that point where it understood the value of corporate social responsibility.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.